Tonight, as we continue in the 10th chapter, it starts in verse 1, and after Abimelech, there arose to defend Israel Tola, the son of Pua, the son of fellow with a weird name, Dudu, or whatever you want to pronounce it. How'd you like to name your kids after these fellows here? Tola and Pua and Dudu, and sounds like a Walt Disney cartoon to me. A man of Eshkar, and he dwelt in Shamar in Mount Ephraim. Now, this man judged Israel 23 years and died and was buried in Shamar. Now, in closing the 9th chapter last week, we saw that one of the sons of Gideon, his name was Abimelech, he was born to a kind of a handmaid of Gideon's. He wasn't really, this woman wasn't his wife. And the other sons of Gideon and him kind of were in conflict with one another. Well, Abimelech went to Shechem where he lived, and he got the men of Shechem to rally behind him. And then he went and he slew, you remember, the 70 sons or the sons of Gideon. And he kind of reigned with terror. And he came to a vicious and horrible death. The end of chapter 9, when they went to Thebes, in verse 50 of chapter 9, Abimelech, and encamped against it, that there was a tower within the city, and they were coming up against the tower, and there was a woman in the tower who threw out a piece of a millstone, and it hit Abimelech on the head, crushed his skull, and he was in the process of probably dying, but he didn't want anyone to be able to say a woman had killed him. So he turned to a fellow and he says, "Thrust me through with your sword, because I don't want it to go down in the records that a woman, you know, killed me by throwing this stone on my head." And so in verse 1 of chapter 10, it says, "And after Abimelech, there arose to defend Israel Tola." And so Abimelech came to a bitter end, a wicked cut off. Now, the name Tola means a worm. Now, whether or not that indicated what kind of a character he was, I don't know. But how'd you like to have the name Worm? Somebody says, "Hi, what's your name?" And you'd say, "Worm." Now, they named babies in those days after experiences or thoughts, or a lot of times they wait till the birth of the child, and then whatever they saw or experienced at that moment, they would give that child that name. If a worm crawled by the minute the mother was giving birth, they'd say, "Let's name him Worm." It's like the story in Samuel when the Ark of the Covenant had been stolen and the woman gave birth to that child. They named it Ichabod. It means the glory hath departed. And I'd like to show up at school and somebody says, "What's your name?" And you say, "The glory hath departed." No one would want to be around you. And so this fellow named Tola dwelt or judged Israel, verse 2, for 23 years, and then he died. Now, we, in tonight's study, get a lot of judges that just had short little reigns, and there isn't really anything said about them. You get into Gideon, you get into Samson, but some of these other judges, there isn't really any commentary on them. So after him, verse 3, there arose Jair and Gileonite, and he judged Israel for 22 years, and he had 30 sons that rode 30 ass colts, and they had 30 cities, which are called Havath Jair, unto this day, which are in the land of Gilead. And Jair died and was buried in Cana. So this guy had 30 sons. You think you've got a lot of kids to deal with. And he provided them all with Porsches, donkeys to ride. In those days, it was the equivalent today's, you know, buy all your sons Porsches to drive. It really was. I mean, it was like a real luxury item. You know, "Dad, can I have a donkey when I turn 16? As some of us would be think that'd be great if we could just do that instead of buying a car for our kids, you know. But anyway, these fellows had their donkeys. Now, verse 6, it said, "The children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served Balaam and Ashtaroth and the gods of Syria and the gods of Zidon and the gods of Moab and the gods of the children of Ammon and the gods of the Philistines, and they forsook the Lord and served him not." That is the book of Judges in a capsule. The last verse of the book of Judges says that every man did that which was right in his own eyes. Divine commentary on the times. So now they're up to their old turning away from Jehovah again, worshiping these pagan gods and the gods of the heathens that are around them. It's so easy for us as Christians to be influenced by the world around us. We really need to keep our guard up. Comes in through television and TV and magazines and through 100,000 other sources. Now, I don't believe that we should be separatists and go around in white robes and live in monasteries, you know, and, you know, don't touch the heathen, they've got cooties kind of a thing. But I think a lot of times, even under grace, we just get too lax, you know, and oh, I've got the liberty and, you know, it won't hurt me. And so I listen to music that's ungodly, it's unedifying, it doesn't promote spirituality, and it just brings me down. And we let these influences come into our minds. That's what happened with the people of Israel. Instead of being a light to the nations, they became like the nations. We need to maintain a separate lifestyle, a commitment to godliness. I love it in the book of Daniel when it says that Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the king's meat. Young man, far away from home in Babylon, he could have just adopted the philosophy, when in Babylon, do as the Babylonians do. I mean, just get drunk, hang out with the, you know, go chase women and just do whatever you want. No one will ever know. Here we're far away from home. But Daniel says, I'm going to stay holy. I'm going to stay committed to God. You know, everybody's getting drunk on the job. I'm not going to. Everybody's cheating on their wives. I'm not going to do that. Everybody thinks they can do this and do that and cheat, you know, and I'm not going to follow the crowd. I'm going to stand apart. I'm going to be a testimony and a witness to them with God's help and God's strength. I know it's not easy because of that pull and the influence. Many of you on your secular jobs daily have to rub elbows with the world, and it's just a constant kind of a drain. You need to come home daily from working out in the world and have the Lord just kind of cleanse you and refresh you and just sit before the Lord. Ask the Lord to spiritually just work. You know, it's like Peter, having been bathed, he needed his feet washed. You've been cleansed and forgiven of your sins, but you go out in the world and you pick up all the defilement of the day, and you need to come home at the end of the day and just say, Lord, get that trash out of my mind. All the garbage I've had to listen to and see and hear, and just cleanse my heart. But the children of Israel were constantly in this cycle, falling into this idolatry, falling into idolatry, being pushed into the ways of the world. It's sad to say that that's pretty much the commentary in a lot of Christians' lives too. They're up, they're down, they're up and they're down. Now it goes on and it says that that year they vexed and oppressed the children of Israel. How amazing that they would go, the children of Israel, and worship these gods of the heathen, and then these other nations will come and oppress them and bring them into bondage. You turn away from the Lord, and I can guarantee you, you're going to go into bondage. There's not going to be any joy or any peace or any happiness in your life. And so they did this for 18 years, and all the children of Israel that were on the other side of the Jordan in the land of the Amorites and in Gilead, and moreover, the children of Ammon passed the Jordan to fight against Israel and Judah, and against Benjamin and against the house of Ephraim, so that Israel was sore distressed. You see, sin brings misery. Righteousness exalteth a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. And so it's true in our own individual lives. You follow God and obey His commandments, and God will bless you. You can't go wrong. But it's when you start dabbling in sin and play with the world that you're brought into bondage. And so it says that the children of Israel, verse 10, cried unto the Lord, saying, We have sinned against thee, both because we have forsaken our God, and also and served Balaam. So they cry out again to God. And the Lord said unto the children of Israel, Did not I deliver you from the Egyptians, and from the Amorites, and from the children of Ammon, and from the Philistines, and from the Zidonians also, and the Amalekites, and the Midianites, that did oppress you, and you cried to me, and I delivered you out of their hand. Yet ye have forsaken me, and served other gods. Therefore, I will deliver you no more. Go and cry unto the gods which you have chosen, and let them deliver you in the time of your tribulation." Now, that verse is awesome. These children of Israel crying out to God again. And can you imagine the horror that swept over them when God's voice came back and says, "Forget it. You've been serving these other gods. You've been worshiping these gods carved out of stones and wood. And now you're crying out to me in your distress." God says, "Why don't you go call out to the gods that you've been serving and see if they'll deliver you in your time of need?" You know, there's so many people that don't want to have anything to do with God until they're in a hot spot, until they're in trouble. You don't hear from them for months and months and months, and then there's a tragedy in the home, and then they're on the phone calling the pastor. "Could you come down to the hospital right away? We need your prayers." Things go wrong in their life, and then it's, "Oh, honey, I think it's time to turn to God." It's time to turn to God when things are going good. It's like we always use prayer as a last resort. Like that story about the ocean liner that was sinking. And the woman ran to the captain, and the captain says, "It's pretty bad. I think we're going to go under. I think it's time to pray." And the woman says, "Is it that bad?" Like, man, if it's time to pray, that's bad. "Honey, I think things are bad. I think it's time to pray. Lord, help us." And we call out to God, and God says, "You've been serving your money. Go call out to your money. You've been serving your occupation. Go cry out to your occupation. You've been worshiping your tennis racket. You have a need? Call out to your tennis racket, please deliver me in my hour of need." And there'll be no response. It's just a dead stick. You've been worshiping your ATC, your motorcycle, or your camper, or your RV, you know. It's become your God. And then things go wrong. You go, "Oh, Winnebago, please deliver me," you know. "Oh, thou Winnebago, please help me," you know, and you're calling out to your gods and there's no response. We know who can help us. When the chips are down, we turn to God. And God says, "Go call on the gods that you've been serving. Go call on those heathen gods and see if they can deliver you in your hour of need." This is heavy stuff. God's just rebuking them on the spot. And so the children of Israel said unto the Lord, "We have sinned. Do thou unto us whatsoever seemeth good unto thee. Deliver us only, we pray thee, this day." And so they put away the strange gods from among them, and they began once again to serve the Lord. And the Lord's soul, it says, was grieved for the misery of Israel. Then the children of Ammon were gathered together and encamped against Gilgal. Now, what that means, verse 16, is that God had pity, God had compassion, and God did deliver them. God brings about in chapter 11, Jephthah becomes the judge that delivers them from the oppression at this time. And so the children of Ammon gathered together, verse 17, and encamped against Gilgal, and the children of Israel assembled themselves together and encamped in Mizpah, which means watchtower. And the people and the princes of Gilead said one to another, "What man is he that will begin to fight against the children of Ammon, and he shall be head over all the inhabitants of Gilead?" Now, Jephthah, this is the man that would deliver them, the Gileadite, was a mighty man of valor, and he was the son of a harlot. And Gilead begat Jephthah. And Gilead's wife bare him sons, and his wife's sons grew up, and thrust out Jephthah, and said unto him, "Thou shalt not inherit our father's house, for thou art the son of a strange woman. And so his half-brothers rejected him. And Jephthah fled, verse 3, from his brethren and dwelt in the land of Tob. And there were gathered vain men to Jephthah and went out with them. These are again the lewd fellows of the baser sort. And it came to pass in the process of time, how much time we don't know, that the children of Ammon made war against Israel. And it was so that when the children of Ammon made war against Israel, that the elders of Gilead went to fetch, guess who? Jephthah, out of the land of Tob. And so they say, hey, we'll go get that guy we rejected and let him lead us. And so they said unto Jephthah, come and be our captain, for we may fight with the children of Ammon. And Jephthah said unto the elders of Gilead, did not you hate me and expel me out of my father's house? Why are you come unto me now, you in your distress? And the elders of Gilead said unto Jephthah, therefore we turn again to thee now, that thou mayest go with us and fight against the children of Ammon, and be our head over all the inhabitants of Gilead. And Jephthah said unto the elders of Israel, or the elders of Gilead, if you bring me home again to fight against the children of Ammon, and the Lord deliver them before me, shall I be your head? And the elders of Gilead said unto Jephthah, the Lord be witness between us, if we do not so according to thy words. And so Jephthah went with the elders of Gilead, and the people made him head of the captain over them. And Jephthah uttered all his words before the Lord in Mizpah. And Jephthah sent messengers unto the king of the children of Ammon, saying, what hast thou to do with me that thou hast come against me to fight in my land? And the king of the children of Ammon answered and said to the messengers of Jephthah, because Israel took away our land when they came up out of the land of Egypt, from Arnon, even from Jabbok, unto Jordan. Now therefore restore the land again peaceably. And Jephthah sent messengers again unto the king of the children of Ammon, and said unto him, thus saith Jephthah, Israel took not away the land of Moab, nor the land of the children of Ammon. And so when they called Jephthah, Jephthah says, okay, I'll do it, but are you going to let me be your head? They say, yeah, no problem. Then Jephthah calls to the king of Ammon, and he says, what's the big deal here? Why are you coming against us? And king of Ammon says, because when you came out of Egypt, you took my land. Jephthah says, no way. Now, it's quite detailed, and I'm going to skip over this section. You either should have read it before you came doing your homework, or you can read it when you go back to pick up this section. But Jephthah basically corrects the king of Ammon and shows him how that when they came into the land, first of all, if you go down to verse 22, was possessed by the Ammonites rather than the Amorites. Kind of sounds close to the same. But in verse 22, he says, they possessed all the coast of the Amorites from Arnon even unto Jabbok, and from the wilderness even unto Jordan. Now the Lord God of Israel had depossessed the Amorites from before the people of Israel, and shouldest thou go back and possess it? Wilt not thou possess that which Chemosh thy God giveth to thee to possess? So whomsoever the Lord our God shall drive out from before us, them will we drive out. Now, he says at the end of verse 26, you had 300 years. Why did you not recover the land at that time? In other words, he says, hey, when we came and took the land, it wasn't your land at that time, it was somebody else's. And you had 300 years to take the land, so you didn't take it that time. We went in. He says, basically, hey, when we go take land, we take land. And when we take land, it's ours. You know, it's interesting today, and I don't want to get too sidetracked, but in Israel, how that Israel can be attacked by their enemy, that the enemy initiates the attack, Israel pushes back the enemy, gaining some of the enemy's territory, so-called, it's really not, but gaining some of the enemy's territory, Golan Heights, Western Bank, they gave the Sinai up. And then all their enemies, after the war is over, they say, now, give us back our land. And if I was Israel, I'd say, stop attacking us. It's like they want to attack them, and then they want, we take their land, and Israel takes their land, and then they want to give it back. It's just stupid. The whole world's making a big stink about the Golan Heights, ought to give back to Syria. Syria's now moved into southern Lebanon again, the Bekaa Valley, and they're shelling northern Galilee, and it's just any moment war is going to break out. Both sides know there's going to be war again, and Syria is armed to the teeth by the Soviet Union. Any full-scale war between Syria and Israel is going to, if not draw them in, be very close to drawing the Russians in, which could be a fulfillment of Ezekiel 38 and 9. And they're ready to go over there right now. But it's funny, you know, give the Syrians Golan Heights back. Well, tell them to stop attacking us. They attack them, and then they take their land, and then they want to give the land back. Egypt attacks Israel. Israel captures the Sinai Peninsula, and then Israel gives it back to the Egyptians after they build oil wells and runways and all these things, and then they give back, you know, pretty good deal. And all the world is all bummed out at Israel. Jephthah says, hey, it never was your land in the first place, and besides that, he says, when we wipe out an enemy, we wipe him out, and it's our land when we take it. And so it says, verse 28, however, the king of the children of Ammon hearkened not unto the words of Jephthah, which he sent to him. And then the Spirit, verse 29, of the Lord came upon Jephthah, and it says that he passed over Gilead, Manasseh, and he came over Mizpah, in Gilead, and from Mizpah to Gilead, he passed over the children of Ammon. And Jephthah vowed a vow unto the Lord and said, if thou wilt without fail deliver the children of Ammon into my hands, then it shall be that whosoever cometh forth of the doors of my house to meet me, when I return in peace from the children of Ammon, shall surely be the Lord's, and I will offer it up for a burnt offering. Now, some of you are familiar with this story. It's leading into a story that's quite controversial and a situation that a lot of people don't understand. And I must confess, I don't have any, you know, last word on it. And that is Jephthah's rash, foolish vow. Number one, when Jephthah vowed, he didn't really need to vow. The Lord was with him. The Spirit was on his life. God had called him. All he needed to do was go out against the Ammonites. He didn't have to make some big vow. You know, the Scriptures encourage us to be careful in making vows to God. I wish I'd learned my lesson just to be careful making vows to anybody. Especially to my kids. I'll play with you tomorrow, you know. And then I don't play with them. I'll play with you as soon as I'm done studying, and I don't play with them. You know, why don't I just not say anything and play with them? And if I don't play with them, I haven't opened my mouth. There's a scripture in Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verse 2. I love it. It says, be not rash with thy mouth, and let not thy heart be hasty to utter a thing before God. For God is in heaven, and thou art on earth. Therefore, let thy words be few. I like that. You know, sometimes we just blab too much. Yeah, I'm going to serve God. I'm going to go to Africa, win souls. I'll do this, God. I'll do it. You know, God just might hold you to it. We make all these vows. I'll be there. I'll do this. I'll do that. And we don't follow through on what we vow or we say we're going to do. In the New Testament, it says, let your yes be a yes and your no be a no. Don't have to swear. I swear I'll do it. Well, why do you have to swear you'll do it? Because you're such a liar, nobody can believe you unless you swear. Oh, I just swear I'll do it. Well, don't do that. Don't even swear. Just say I'll do it and then do it. Or say I won't do it and don't do it. Be a man of your word. Just say yes or no and do what you're supposed to do. And don't, you know, be such a flake that you've got to, I'll stand on a stack of Bibles, you know. Mother's honor or whatever, and I'll do what I say I'll do. Usually it's the guys that are just such big liars, they've got to try to convince everybody that they're really going to do it. You know, when we were little kids, we had all kinds of weird things, you know. I'll give you my lizard if I don't do it. And my horny toad. go through all these things, and we just carry that really over with our relationship with God. God, if you'll just give me that new Rolls Royce, I'll use it to bring kids to Sunday school. Promise you, God. And in your mind, you can see yourself just cruising Hollywood Boulevard, you know, looking for girls or something. And God knows your heart. You can't fool God. Oh, goody, goody, Gabriel. If we give him that Rolls Royce, he'll bring kids to Sunday school, you know. Like God gets all turned on in heaven about it or something. And we make these vows and promises to God. God, if you'll just give me a wife, spiritual, cute, all these things, then I promise you I'll be a missionary. No way. So he didn't really need to make his vow. It was kind of a rash vow. But the story goes on in verse 32 that Jephthah passed over into the children of Ammon. You can guess get the drift from what I said that I don't think Jephthah should have made a vow. And so he passed over the children of Ammon to fight against them. And the Lord delivered them into his hand. And he smote them from Aroer even unto, it came to pass to Minnah, even 20 cities under the plain of the vineyards with very great slaughter. Thus the children of Ammon were subdued before the children of Israel. Now, there's a real good reason why Jephthah shouldn't have made his foolish vow. And Jephthah came to Mizpah unto his house, and behold, his daughter came out to meet him with tambourines and with dances. And she was his only child, and beside her he had neither son nor daughter. And it came to pass that when he saw her, that he ripped his clothes. And he said, Alas, my daughter, thou hast brought me very low. Thou art one of them that trouble me, for I have opened my mouth unto the Lord, and I cannot go back. And she said unto him, My father, if thou hast opened thy mouth unto the Lord, do to me according to that which thou hast proceeded out of thy mouth, for as much as the Lord hath taken vengeance of thee and thine enemies, even of the children of Ammon. And she said unto her father, Let this thing be done for me, but let me alone for 2 months, that I may go up and down in the mountains and bewail my virginity, I and my fellows. And he said, Go. And he sent her away for 2 months, and she went with her companions and bewailed her virginity upon the mountains. And it came to pass at the end of 2 months that she returned of her father, who did with her according to his vow, which he had vowed, and she knew no man. Notice that phrase, she knew no man. And it was a custom in Israel that all the daughters of Israel went yearly to meet the daughter of Jephthah, the Gileadite, 4 days in a year. Now, the big question is, did Jephthah sacrifice his daughter, in other words, kill her? Give her unto the Lord as a human sacrifice. It would seem as though we don't know for sure. There's good scholarship and good arguments on both sides. The two positions are, first of all, number one, that in the Hebrew, at the end of verse 3, the word and in our King James Bible could be translated or. And it's possible. There's no problem with that. And that what Jephthah was saying in his vow, if you look there again with me, was, he says, When I shall return in peace from the children of Ammon, he says, Whatever comes forth from my house shall surely be the Lord's. Period. Then he says, Or I will offer for burnt offerings. Now, a lot of commentators feel that there was two things he vowed that he would do. Whatever came out of the house, he was thinking in terms of a sheep or an oxen or a goat. You see, in Bible days, goats came in the house, pigs came in the house, you know, animals came in the house, cruised in and out. No big deal. Matter of fact, they'd bring them all in at night with the family and the kids and the goats, and everybody would go to bed together at night. Sounds fun, doesn't it? And so Jephthah probably figured a goat would come cruising out. And he would sacrifice to the Lord, whatever. But basically the idea is that whatever comes out, I'll give to the Lord. Or if nothing comes out, I'll just offer a sacrifice to you, or I'll give a sacrifice to you. And that what Jephthah did to his daughter was force her to not marry, and that she remained a virgin throughout life. Which is interesting because in verse 39, it says that she went around bewailing her virginity on the mountains with her companions, as that she knew no man, and it was a custom in Israel. So it mentions that, their virginity, and that she knew no man, and so forth. But like I said, that's just one possibility. That he didn't sacrifice her, he didn't kill her, he just made her stay a virgin the rest of her life. J. Vernon McGee takes this position. Or that he indeed did sacrifice her, which I don't believe would really turn God on or be pleasing to God or make God happy. There's a verse in Deuteronomy chapter 12, verse 31, where God specifically tells the children of Israel not to offer their children in sacrifice, human sacrifice. That's what the gods of the heathens were doing. The heathens were offering their children in human sacrifice to Baal. That isn't what God wanted. Abraham had the knife to slay his son Isaac, and God stopped him and didn't allow him to kill him. So I'm of the feeling that he didn't kill her, but I can't be dogmatic about it. And it's possible he did, and if he did, he did. It's just giving the narrative, it's stating the way it is, and it doesn't shake my faith in God. I do think that Jephthah was kind of stupid for making the vow, but it doesn't, you know, make me think the Bible's dumb or flaky or anything like that. Really, you know, why some people make a big deal out of it, I don't know. You know, it just says what it says, and I believe it, and it doesn't matter what happened. I'm just going to take the text for what it is if you want, and that's fine. So, it says that every year they would go around bewailing her virginity. Now, the story goes on in chapter 12. It says that the men of Ephraim gathered themselves together, and they went northward, and they're upset with Jephthah because he didn't invite them to fight with him. Every these guys, after the battle's over, everybody gets mad because they weren't invited. Wherefore, passest thou over to fight against the children of Ammon? You didn't invite us to go to war with you. Now, I wouldn't have any problems with that. If you don't want to invite me to go to battle, that's fine with me. Now, Jephthah said, verse 2, unto them, I and my people were at great strife with the children of Ammon. And when I called you, you delivered me not out of their hands. And when I saw that you delivered me not, I put my life in my hands and passed over against the children of Ammon, and the Lord delivered them into my hands. Wherefore are you come up against me this day to fight against me? And Jephthah gathered together all the men of Gilead and fought with Ephraim. So now you got civil war. They're fighting each other because they weren't invited to fight. You talk about confusion. This period of Judges is one of the darkest periods in the nation of Israel. Civil war, anarchy, apostasy, idolatry. And it's all because they were all sinning and turning away from Jehovah. And so now you have Ephraim fighting the Gileadites. And it says that Gilead smote Ephraim because they said, you Gileadites are fugitives of Ephraim among the Ephraimites and among the Manassites. And the Gileadites took the passage of the Jordan. And the Ephraimites, and it was so that when those Ephraimites which were escaped said, let me go over. That the men of Gilead said unto them, art thou an Ephraimite? And if they said, no, I'm not, then they said unto him, now say Sibboleth or Shibboleth. And they said Shibboleth, for he could not frame the pronounce it right. Then they took him and slew him at the passage of Jordan. And there fell at that time of the Ephraimites 42,000. And Jephthah judged Israel for 6 years, then died, the Gileadite, which was buried in one of the cities of Gilead. Now, this story has always been interesting to me. There's this fighting between the Gileadites and the Ephraimites. And the Gileadites go down and they take the fords of the Jordan. That means the Jordan River that ran north and south through Israel. They were blocking the Gileadites from the Ephraimites from passing over. And so when they would come down, when an Ephraimite was escaped, verse 5, and wanted to go over, they would ask him, they would say, are you an Ephraimite? And he'd say, no. And then they'd make him pronounce this word, because evidently the Ephraimites had a certain kind of, you know, slang or pronunciation, or, you know, draw or something like that, you all or something. And, you know, the different tribes actually had different languages. You know, in the New Testament, Peter was from Galilee, and they said, surely this man's a Galilean, his speech betrayeth him. He's from Galilee. And he had this accent. And so they said, say Sibboleth. And the guys go, you know, his life depended on it. And he thought, you know, let me get this framed. Sibboleth, you know. And he'd mispronounce it, and they said, stick him with a sword. Can you imagine the pressure on you to pronounce it Sibboleth just right, you know? I mean, these guys, let me try one more time, okay? And so they're trying to pronounce this word. If they couldn't pronounce it right, then they were busted and they would wipe him out. So, just real exciting story, Jephthah. So, verse 8, it says, after him, Isban, he judged for 30 years. Let's just move quickly on these. And he had 30 daughters. I've got 3, but a long way to go for 30. And he judged Israel for 7 years. Then there was Elon, verse 11. He judged Israel for 10 years. Then there was Abaddon, doesn't mention the length of his, or he had 40 sons, verse 14, 30 nephews, and he rode on 70 ass colts. And he judged Israel for 8 years, verse 14. And Abaddon, the son of Helah, the fellow with this weird name and all that, he died. And Ephraim in the mount of the Amalekites, they buried him in the land of Ephraim in the mount of the Amalekites. Chapter 13. Chapter 13, it says that the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord delivered them into the land of the Philistines, or the hand of the Philistines, for 40 years. This becomes the longest oppression during the time of the judges. 40 years. Now, the man who is going to be raised up by God is the man Samson. The ancient Joe Atlas, hippie, Nazarite, long hair, strong man, Samson. Now the children of Israel, up to their old sinning again, did evil in the sight of the Lord, and for 40 years they were under the bondage of the Philistines. Now, it says there was a certain man in Zorah of the family of the Danites whose name was Manoah, and his wife was barren and bare not. And the angel of the Lord, which I believe is a reference to Jesus Christ, especially in light of verse 18, where this angel's name is called Wonderful. The angel of the Lord appeared unto the woman and said unto her, that's Samson's mother, Mrs. Manoah, behold, now thou art barren and bearest not. Thou shalt conceive and bear a son. Now therefore beware, I pray thee, that thou drink not wine nor strong drink, and eat not any unclean thing. For lo, thou shalt conceive and bear a son, and no razor shall come upon his head, for the child shall be a Nazarite unto God from the womb, and he shall begin to deliver Israel out of the hand of the Philistines. Now what you see is the pre-birth stages of the coming of Samson. The interesting thing about Samson is that Samson had a fantastic beginning. Notice it even uses the word begin, verse 5. He shall begin to deliver Israel from the hand of the Philistines. But it doesn't say he shall. It says he'll begin. Samson is the man who could have been, should have been, but wasn't. How often that's the commentary in so many people's lives. They could have been, they should have been, but they failed. Having such potential, glorious birth and beginning and parenting and background and the divine call in their life, Though Samson was strong physically, he was weak morally, and it brought him into bondage, and God put him on the shelf. He was unable to really bring about the full deliverance for the children of Israel. How many men of God, because of the weakness of their flesh, have fallen into sin, who have started off in the race of serving God so well, and then in a weakness of their flesh or a weakness for the opposite sex or whatever it might be, such was the case with Samson, they fall into temptation. And they never complete the work that God called them to do. You know, that's something that we should all be afraid of. We should have kind of a holy fear that we stay true to God and that we don't allow ourselves to fall into sin, that we be disqualified from the race. You're running the race. And if you step out of the line, or you step out of your track, or you run into another runner, or you do something that's illegal, you'll be disqualified from the race. In running our race, we ought to all obey the rules that we can complete the race. Fulfill the call of God upon our life. Live out our calling. Samson had a glorious beginning. I don't know about you, but my mom had no angel appear to her and say, "You're going to have a son." I mean, this is a fantastic, uncommon event. Something special about this kid. God sent an angel from heaven, Mrs. Manoah, and said, "You're going to have a boy. He's going to be a hippie, don't get uptight, when he's a teenager and he's got hair down to his shoulders. But he's a Nazarite, he's to be committed unto me, you know, and never to a razor to come to his head, and don't drink wine or strong drink," and all these things. And this was a special child, but yet he did not complete that which God called him to do. He had a good start, but a bad finish. He only began to deliver the children of Israel. The reason was because of the weakness of his flesh. I know men, physically, just, I mean, these guys are brutes to the max. But morally weak. I've known guys like that. They're really into pumping iron. Big, strong muscle guys. But morally weak. Fall into sin all over the place. If you're out there and you're a 90-pound weakling, don't worry about it. It's not your physical strength that's important to God, it's your spiritual strength. You land on the beach and some muscle guy kicks sand in your face. Just give him a Four Spiritual Laws booklet or something. God loves you and has a wonderful plan for your life. I mean, you know, if you can be physically strong and spiritual too, great. But that's not where it's at. Big deal. Spend hours pumping iron every day, developing these beautiful biceps, and then you can't find any shirts to fit you, you know? "Hey, look at my new shirt." Well, too bad. I just ripped it, you know? Samson was strong, but he was morally weak. Now, in verse 6, when the woman came and told her husband, saying, "A man of God came to me, and his countenance was like the countenance of an angel of God. It was terrible." The King James word for awesome would be better. "But I asked him not whence he was, and whether he told me his name. But he said unto me, 'Behold, thou shalt conceive and bear a son. Don't drink any wine or strong drink, neither eat any unclean thing, for the child shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb, from his day unto his death.'" It's possible that John the Baptist was a Nazarite too. "Now Manoah entreated the Lord and said, 'O my Lord, the man of God which thou didst send, pray that he comes again unto us, that he may teach us what we can do with this child which shall be born.'" Now that's a good prayer. "Lord, send somebody else and tell us how to handle this fellow, you know. What we can do with this child." "And God hearkened to the voice of Manoah. And the angel of God came unto the woman, and she sat in the field, and Manoah, her husband, was not with her. And so the woman made haste, and she ran, and she showed her husband, and she said unto him, 'Behold, the man hath appeared unto me that came unto me the other day.' And so Manoah arose, and he went after with his wife to the man, and he said unto him, 'Art thou the man that spake unto my wife the other day?' And he said, 'Yes, I am.' And Manoah said, 'Now let thy word come to pass. How shall we order the child, and how shall we do unto him?' And the angel of the Lord said unto Manoah, 'Of all that I said unto the woman, let her beware. She may eat not of any unclean thing that, or she may eat nothing that comes of the vine, neither drink any wine or strong drink or any unclean thing all that I commanded her, let her observe. Now, Manoah's kind of like a nervous guy. He just, you know, what do we do? How do we raise him? You know, oh, can the angel come and tell us how to do this again? You know, he's one of these nervous fathers. Brings the baby home from the hospital the first time. Well, you know, it spit up. Oh no, what do we do? You know, freaking out. I remember when we brought Sarah the first time home and she went in her diaper. And we didn't know what to do. It was all gold colored. And we thought, oh no, our child's going to die. This is terrible, you know, it's gold. Wrong color. And we called the pediatrician. You know, doctor, our daughter just went, you know, and it's gold and stuff. And he goes, gold is high on the market right now. You know, we're all just, wow, what do? We're in a big panic. We think our kid's dying on us or something. He says, don't worry about it. They'll live. That's the cool thing about the time you have three or, you know, down the line. First one, you're just over everything. You're all worried. What do we do? You know, I don't know. Oh, watch out, it spit up, you know, and you're running around. Third one, come, you just throw it in its room, you know, and figure 16 years later, it'll come cruising out or something. No biggie, you know. You just kind of second hat, you know. So Manoah's all uptight, and the angel came again, and I see comedy in this myself. Manoah's just saying, what do we do? How do we connect? And the angel says, hey, I already told your wife. Just do all that I told her. I already told her. And then he repeated himself, like, you know, some big profound thing. It's like the angel just saying, hey, I've got other things to do, you know. Called me all the way down from heaven to tell you the same thing I've told you three times. So, Manoah says, verse 15, I said unto the angel, I pray thee of the Lord, let us detain thee until we shall have made ready a kid for thee. He wanted to show him hospitality. And the angel of the Lord said unto Manoah, see, they don't really even know it's an angel yet. They're just trying to be nice to this man of God. The angel of the Lord said unto Manoah, though thou detain me, I will not eat any of thy bread. And if thou wilt offer a burnt offering, thou mayest offer it unto the Lord. For Manoah knew not that he was an angel of the Lord. And so Manoah said unto the angel of the Lord, what is thy name? When thy saying comes to pass, that we may do thee honor. And the angel of the Lord said unto him, why do you ask after my name, seeing it is wonderful? That's what the word in the Hebrew means, wonderful. Now, Manoah didn't know that he was an angel. In Hebrews chapter 13, verse 2, it says, be careful how you entertain strangers, for some have entertained angels unaware. You ever thought about that? A person you allowed to come in and stay in your home and fed maybe was an angel. Be careful how you treat people or treat people, you know, that you meet. You never know. They might be an angel. How will I know it's an angel? I don't know. We used to joke, maybe you see the overcoat sticking up from the wings underneath, you know. His hat floating off his head from the halo or something. You don't know. But I believe angels can take human form. And angels can appear to help us or deliver us or whatever. God can send angels to work on our behalf. They're ministering spirits sent forth to minister to those who are heirs of salvation, includes you and I. And so Manoah runs and gets together this kid. And Manoah took the kid, verse 19, with a meat offering, and he offered it upon the rock of the Lord. And the angel did wondrously, and Manoah and his wife looked on. Means they were just blown away. They were just freaked out. And it came to pass that when the flame went up toward heaven from off the altar of the Lord, that the angel of the Lord ascended in the flame of the altar. And Manoah and his wife looked on it, fell on their faces to the ground, and the angel of the Lord did no more appear unto Manoah and his wife, and Manoah knew that it was an angel of the Lord. And Manoah said unto his wife, we're going to die. See, I told you this guy was a nervous wreck. This guy was a basket case. He said, we're going to die. Because we've seen God. But his wife, a little more stable and sane, said unto him, Dear, if the Lord were pleased to kill us, would he have received our burnt offering and our meat offering at our hands? Neither would he have showed us all these things, nor would at this time have told us such things as these. Manoah can be thankful for his wife. Good, sound, level-headed woman. Keeps him in line. I like that when a woman can straighten out her husband and put him on track. You know that the Hebrews actually felt that to see an angel meant death? That's why when in the New Testament they saw an angel, so they just freaked out every time they saw him. Manoah, we're going to die, we're going to die. And his wife says, I mean, she rations and lies. It seems like, why would God do all this and kill us? And, you know, this just doesn't make sense. And he's, yeah, that's right, you know. I mean, letting his wife console him, you know, and he's biting his fingernails. In the New Testament, Gabriel appears to Mary, and she's full of fear, troubled. I've often thought it's kind of like Casper the Friendly Ghost, you know. Nice guy, but every time he shows up, everybody screams and yells and runs away. Poor Gabriel, every time he shows up to somebody, an angel, and they run away. It's kind of a trial. So it says that she calmed him down. And then I love it, verse 24 and 5. It says that the woman bare a son and called his name Samson. And the child grew, and the Lord blessed him. And the Spirit of the Lord began to move on him at times in the camp of Dan between Zorah and Eshtol. Now, the interesting thing about Samson is that he is mentioned in Hebrews chapter 11. Let's just close by looking at Hebrews 11, verse 32. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 32. It says in Hebrews, this is the great heroes of faith. The great heroes of faith, and we have Samson. Start at verse 31. The writer of Hebrews says, By faith the harlot Rahab perished not with them that believed not, when she had received the spies with peace. And what shall I more say? For the time would fail to tell me of Gideon, Judges chapter 7, and of Barak in the book of Judges, and of Samson, and of Jephthah, and of David also, and of Samuel, and of the prophets. Who through faith subdued kingdoms, wrought righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of the fire, escaped the edge of the sword, and out of weakness were made strong, waxed valiant in fight, and turned to flight the armies of the aliens. And so Samson is in the hall of faith. And I want you to hang on to these verses, the things we've covered tonight. It'll be 2 weeks before we pick Samson back up. But truly, in the next couple chapters on Samson, there are some very, very important lessons in for us on temptation. And I think it's a key issue in our lives that we need to learn how to face temptation. We need to learn how the devil comes and attacks us. We need to learn how we can resist the devil, resist temptation, and how we can face the enemy. And we'll see that develop in Samson as we go through. Now, though Samson had a good beginning, he was weak morally, God still included him in Hebrews chapter 11. God didn't say, boy, you know, Samson was just such a flake. Let's just erase him out of Hebrews 11. It's the grace of God. And I don't care how weak you are or how failing you are, God can always pick you up, put the pieces back together, and put you back in service. You'll just surrender yourself to Him. Let's pray.